This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger, and good morning to you and good morning to the world as we come your way from, well, Huntley, Illinois. It's a little bit of WGN West, not quite far west as Scottsdale, Arizona, where we work at times. But anyway, as I said in the conversation with Matt and Roger earlier, surprised that only 0.04 of an inch of rain in my rain gauge so far this morning. Sounds like more will be on the way during the day. But we're into that season of county fairs, and pretty soon state fairs will get underway. Wisconsin always leading that parade in early August with the state fair up at West Allis, just west of Milwaukee. But in addition to that, the tractor show season is underway. And starting last Thursday, continuing through tomorrow in Penfield, Illinois, the I&I Antique Tractor and Gas Engine Club staging historic farm days at Penfield. Max Armstrong there, and he'll be checking in from there over the weekend. But we hope they get good weather because it's a great show. And if you like old tractors and old machinery, if you like a look at farm the way it used to be, is no longer, but it used to be, I think you will enjoy some of the daily events like corn crib filling and shelling, threshing and baling, potato digging, wheat harvest, tractor parade, kids pedal pull, sawmill except for the lunch hours, blacksmith shop, log cabin open daily, and lawn and garden tractor display, and an impressive truck display. All of that going on through tomorrow evening in Penfield, Illinois, downstate Illinois. And while we're talking about activities and events, let me mention Allendale, which is a market analyst firm based in McHenry, Illinois, and we feature folks from Allendale often here on the air, and they have coming up the Ag Leaders Conference Series. It'll be July when they talk about weather outlook, July 24th, July 25th. They'll be talking about grains and oil seeds. And on July 26th, they'll be talking about livestock markets and activity. So look at the Allendale website, get all the information you need. Should be a very informative gathering. They do this every year, two or three times, as a matter of fact. But Allendale, the place to go for that kind of market analysis and information. So all of that going on, it's a busy time, and we're continuing to watch crops grow rapidly. A week ago, as I mentioned on Monday of this week, a week ago, we flew Air Orion from Huntley, Illinois, up to Viroqua, Wisconsin, across parts of northern Illinois and into southern Wisconsin. Flew up at about 4,500 feet, and I'll tell you, the landscape below us, as lush and green as I've ever seen it at this time of the year. And several people have emailed me over the past couple of weeks saying corn by the 4th of July was much taller than knee-high. And, you know, that was the standmark that we watched, knee-high by the 4th of July. But that ended about 15 years ago, and mostly because of the genetics and the technology that goes into the seed product today. So, yeah, it's not, well, half a mile from where I'm talking right now, there are cornfields that are going into tasseling, which is the beginning of the formation of the corn cob and the corn kernel, and it's tall, shoulder high, head high in some places. So, all of that, but we're going to talk about some tree problems that are cropping up here in the Midwest. Jim Fazell standing by to join us when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Time for Jim Fazell, our specialist in ornamental horticulture, to join us here on the Saturday Morning Show. And two or three weeks ago, Jim, I mentioned a tree problem that's being looked at here in the Chicago area, and we never did get to a further discussion. So can we do that this morning?
Yes, we can, as a matter of fact. A lot of problems with trees, and several weeks ago we talked about trees in general. I think you were talking about an article that appeared in the Tribune having to do with particularly evergreen trees, and right. We're having just an awful time with evergreen trees. As you walk around or drive around through the communities, you see them that are absolutely dead or have big brown patches in them where branches have died off on them, and there are some things that are happening to them. First of all, the pines and the spruces that we grow here as ornamental trees generally are not native to this area. They're from other parts of the country, farther north, different soils, different climate altogether. So they're really at a disadvantage here. Now, we can create a pretty good environment for them so that they survive pretty well, but generally here it's too hot, our soils are too alkaline, and they simply do not like our hot, dry summers. Now, much of the trouble that we have is a result of these adverse situations. We have two droughty summers, and we've got another one going on here in some places. We had some snowless, very cold winters where the ground froze down 5 feet deep. But we have also a lot of mature, older trees, and as things get older, I guess you and I can attest to that, we're not quite as resistant to the stresses that come along, and we're more apt to catch things. But anyway, as far as the spruces are concerned, we have the drought damage which is occurring on these, and some of these spruce trees have been absolutely killed outright because the root systems were desiccated. They simply never did recover. And they're kind of like Christmas trees. They take a long time for the top to die, even though there's no root on the bottom of. Generally, when you see this, the whole tree kind of turns a reddish-green color, and eventually the needles turn brown and dry up. Now, we have another thing that's happening where we have, both on the blue spruces and on the Norway spruces, we have branches throughout the tree, generally lower on the tree, but moving up and killing the tree from the bottom up. If you look at these branches, it looks like a bird perched on there and left bird droppings. This is Cytospora canker. It is a canker disease. There's no cure for the thing, and it is a result of the trees being under particular stress. The other one that is occurring quite obviously around here is a thing we call needle cast, and this is almost always on blue spruces. The symptoms occur 1 year after infection. They affect the older needles, the one-year-old needles, which turn brown and drop off the tree, leaving just the tip of the branch green. This disease can be controlled. It means spraying with Daconil to protect the new growth, and that has to be done this time of year. Protect the new growth for this year so it won't die next year when the other new growth is coming on. But that means you're going to have to spray these trees usually about three times from the time the needles begin to come out, the little candles begin to come out. Spray them about three times during the season. For a lot of people, this is not reasonable, and they kind of just let the trees go. Now, as far as the pines are concerned, the thing that's most common on those is a disease which we've called diplodia or spheropsis, one or the other, back and forth, depending on who decides how they should, what name they should apply to the thing. Researchers are always working on things where they change names depending on the organism and so forth, and one of the things they like to do is confuse us horticulturists, but that's anyway, this is a stress-related disease again, but it's not completely stress-related, although it's more serious where trees are under stress, though it can occur in other places as well. the control of the thing is to improve the situation that these plants are in. So they have plenty of room to grow. They're not in too hard a soil or too cramped in their space, too close to a building or to each other. And once you've got them to where they're in a real good situation, then you can pretty well control this thing with thiophanate methyl, which is a fungicide that can be applied to these trees. And it has to be applied three times again when the needles come out and halfway out and all the way out. This will keep it under control, but the most important thing is to make sure the growing conditions are the best you can provide. There's another disease that's affecting pines, and it's in this area, though we don't see it quite as often. This is pine wilt disease. It is a vascular disease that's carried by a beetle or pine Sawyer beetles that feed on the tops of the trees, and they inoculate these trees with the disease the same way as the beetles inoculated elms for Dutch elm disease. Pine wilt disease, it's here. If you see a tree that's dying from this or you think it's dying from this, it can be sampled to make sure exactly what it is. The disease itself is not a fungus or bacterium. It's a nematode, a tiny microscopic worm that fills up the vascular tissues in the pine. And samples can be taken from the tree to make sure that's what you have. The best thing to do with all of these situations is if you have a pine tree that's in problem or a spruce tree that's in trouble, contact a certified arborist to come out and take a look at the thing and make sure that the conditions are as good as you can give them. Another thing that you can do on some of these plants is make sure that when we have a drought situation as we have now, they get thoroughly watered. We're going to talk about watering in just a second. You can trim to remove the diseased branches. Eventually, you remove so many that the tree doesn't look very good, and the best thing then is to take it out. Rake up the old debris every fall from the trees. Dispose of it as best you can. And this may help reduce the amount of inoculum for the following year. But finally, if you're going to take a tree out, don't replace it with another blue spruce or one of the pine trees and so forth. Put another tree in there that is more tolerant of our kinds of conditions in this part of the country. Now we need to talk very quickly about watering. Things are drying up very quickly right now. Are we in Greg Solier's dry month? I haven't talked to him.
Well, I talked to him, and I don't think we're quite there yet.
Okay, well, this is just a foretaste of things to come. Water is expensive, and we need to use it. We don't want to waste it, even though we have this great big pond out the east of us here. It's still expensive to get to it, and we need to use it responsibly. We need to prioritize our plantings. Newly planted things need to be spot watered to keep them growing, to make sure they don't succumb to this weather. New trees, you can set a hose under the tree and let it run slowly. If you can get one of these irrigator bags, they call them gators, fill it with 20 gallons of water and let it run overnight. You can do that maybe once a week or every 10 days. With mature trees, you need to set a sprinkler under the tree to cover the whole area under the drip line. Put a coffee can out there and measure the amount of water that you get. When you get an inch and a half of water in the can, move the sprinkler. And this needs to be repeated every 7 to 10 days. With shrubs, soaker hoses work, hand watering works, or sprinklers if you can set them so they just cover the shrubs. Out in the flower gardens, drip watering, if you can do that, is a real good way to do it. It only puts water on the plants, or hand water, or if you have to set a sprinkler because you have a big flower garden or vegetable garden, be sure that you put down 1 inch of water. Do it early in the day so the plants dry off before nightfall so that you don't get disease problems. But be sure that you put a measured 1 inch down each time, and then don't water again until the plants wilt again. Out in the lawn, we still see people that are out hand watering. This is really useless as far as the grass is concerned, although it may be good for the spirit or relieve your anxieties and so forth. But you need to use a set sprinkler or an irrigation system. Water when the grass begins to wilt. Again, apply a measured 1 inch of water. Don't water again until the grass begins to wilt again. Frequent shallow watering is not good for the grass, and it is expensive. This is one of the problems with irrigation systems that run by a clock. If you can turn it off and just turn the clock back on when the plant needs or the grass needs to be watered, that works real well. Overwatering or shallow watering isn't good for the grass or for the trees that are growing in the grass either. Native plants generally are able to stand this kind of weather, so if you're really tired of watering, maybe you can revert to replanting with native types of plant material that have grown up in this kind of situation.
You know, I'll repeat one thing you just said, because I see it so often. people holding a hose and waving it over the lawn and thinking they're getting the lawn watered. You said hand watering is useless.
Yeah, it is, as far as the grass is concerned, because in order to get an inch of water down on a front yard that's 25 by 25, it takes maybe 600 gallons of water. Well, your hose is put out maybe 3 or 4 gallons a minute, so you're going to sit there a lot of minutes before you get enough water down.
And then just one other comment. When I moved into the house in Arizona, I found out the cost of water in the desert. First water bill I thought was an offer for my house because they appreciate the value of water out there. Well, Jim, thank you very much. We look forward to your visits here. And that's our weekly chat with Jim Fazell, specialist in ornamental horticulture, here on the Saturday Morning Show. We're at 26 minutes after 5 o'clock here on this Saturday morning. Some rain showers across the Midwest. And I depend a great deal on the Reuters News Service for the news and information we get dealing with agriculture and with agricultural markets. But this week on the Reuters Service, a headline intrigued me. Wisconsin woman to celebrate 100th birthday. Well, that's unusual on a service that provides market information and other information to devote a story to a 100th birthday because it's not unusual anymore. People celebrate 100 years of life. But let me quote just part of this story. Hard work and a positive attitude seem to be the secret to long life for Jane Macomb, who turns 100 on July 19th, next week. Macomb, who moved to Beloit Senior Living a year ago from Suring, Wisconsin, lives independently in her on-site apartment, is on the go, and is in almost perfect health. She attends exercise class and book club, does crafts, and stops in at happy hour. And she enjoys an occasional nip of gin. To celebrate her many happy years, there are going to be a couple of birthday parties, but her background is interesting, and if you're in the dairy business, particularly with Jersey cows, you will recognize the family name. She was a city girl who grew up to have a rural heart. She grew up in Chicago as an only child. Her parents had divorced. She grew up with a single mother, unusual at the time for a Catholic family. She worked for John Hancock Insurance in Chicago after graduating high school in 1937. And then the city girl's life took a sharp turn after she married her husband, Austin, in 1941. And the two decided to take over Hillview Jersey Farm in Suring, Wisconsin. She moved into the farmhouse with her in-laws and learned how to cook, wash, and milk cows. And in the community of 660 people, she adjusted to rural life. Nearly 100 years of age, she now smiles about her farm days, which she considered a lot of work, but also fun. And her daughter, Alice Olson, told the Beloit Daily News they had notoriety of being the second highest producing Jersey herd for butterfat in the state of Wisconsin. So, happy birthday to Jane Macomb. She'll be celebrating her birthday next week, her 100th birthday, and we join her many friends in wishing her a happy birthday. Coming up to the halfway mark here on the Saturday Morning Show, and when we come back, we're going to talk about one of the USDA reports that came out this past week, and we'll be joined by Jerry Gulkey of the Gulkey Group. Indeed, we are back, and Max Armstrong will be checking in during this half hour and learn a little bit more about the event down at Penfield, Illinois this weekend. But right now, at 25 minutes before 6 o'clock, we say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored sponsored by the folks at Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I am Orion, and this week talking about the scope of agriculture. Those of you who are involved in agriculture on a daily basis probably don't take the time to think about some of the numbers you're dealing with. The scope of agriculture, not only in America, but throughout the world. To feed a population that now is nearing 8 billion people on the planet. So let me share these headlines with you. In China, chickens need to lay 1 billion eggs a day to meet demand. 400,000 chicks are hatched every day in one new hatchery in northern China. Part of the rapidly expanding supply chain in China's $37 billion egg industry, which, by the way, is the world's largest. The country, of course, also number one in pork production and consumption, and the largest buyer of soybeans from the United States. But in China, bigger means better, because it gives better control of sanitation challenges, which has plagued China for decades. Then let's talk about almond production. A headline a few days ago reported that California, the Golden State, will produce 2,450 million pounds of almonds this year. That's an all-time record in the state that produces, hear this, 80% of all of the almonds in the world. But then there's the other side of the food story. Dairy farms in this country continue to produce more milk every year, but U.S. consumers are drinking less milk every year. And so Dean Foods, a major processor of milk and dairy products with a long history, has announced the closing of more plants in the United States this year because of less consumption of their products, competition from other beverages, and the false labeling of some of those products. No question that beyond the size of your farm or ranch, agriculture is a huge industry in the world and one that we should all appreciate every day. My thoughts on Samuelson Says, a presentation of the Tribune Radio Networks. Jerry Gahlke of the Gahlke Group standing by to visit with Max and me about one of several government reports affecting agriculture that came out this week. So we'll get to that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, another report this week from the USDA. Was it good news? We're going to find out as we talk to Jerry Gahlke of the Gahlke Group here on This Week in Agribusiness. Jerry, always after a USDA report, my first question is, anything really a surprise?
Yes, I think the surprise, two of them really, in corn, they kept the carryout pretty much stable, and we raised the acres, of course, and that added to more production, but yet the carryout was stayed about the same in that they increased the exports, I think, about 125 million. So now we're still down around that under 1.6 yet, but they only are using 174 for yield, and most of us think it's 178. You could argue about that. If you drive through Illinois, you think it's a 180, you know. But we'll see how that turns out. But they have room now to raise the production and not change exports too much and still not have what we would call burdens of supplies of 2 billion bushels or more for this year at least. The other surprise was in the soybeans, in that they finally came around and did lower the usage by China for this year a little bit from what they were thinking, 100 million, they're down to 97. And then for the following year, they're less than this year at 95 million versus 103, I think they were thinking earlier. Some private analysts had them up to 108 million. So we've seen, I think, a dismissal of this idea that we had China up against the wall, they're back up against the wall, and they're going to have to come to us. They're using less. So that doesn't bode well for soybeans, and the carryover reflected that up over close to 600 million bushels, and I think in the end it'll be over 600 million next year.
And was the soybean number a surprise?
No, not for me, probably for the market, because as you know, we were questioning China's total demand in the first place, and I guess I would be surprised that China this soon quickly reduced our exports by 200 and some million bushels, reflecting probably the fact, as they said they were going to do, the effect of tariffs. And what's interesting is that, you know, they, of course, along with that, they decreased China's imports. So we'll see how all that plays out. Maybe price of beans will be so cheap that we'll create more demand, you know.
How do you see that working, Jerry? How does China ratchet back its demand? I mean, some people have said, hey, they've got the hogs to feed, they've got the demand that is still there. How is that going to work for them?
Well, they have unprofitable hogs to feed. So that's been a nemesis on their part. And, of course, they have said quite a while back, and we looked at it, there's about nine other soybean meal equivalents, cottonseed meal, rapeseed meal, palm oil meal that they can substitute. And they've already gone out and said, you know, we're going to do that. We're going to make this work. And if you think about it, they have their own people behind them. So if they've got to reduce 5% of their meal demand, that's not much considering the demand that they've had. I think they can do that without a hiccup.
Is USDA kind of assuming a pretty robust soybean yield here with the United States? I know they didn't adjust the yield, but they seem to think we're going to have a pretty good bean crop, and it's pretty early in the game for that.
Yeah, it sure looks good. I'm still spraying. I got one more day left, and I will say that the beans look better this time of the year than I've had in a while. Maybe I've learned how to farm finally, but they look good all over. I think the ratings will continue solid and stay up there. You know, like you said, August is a big deal, and of course we still farm in North Dakota or have interest there, and I've been there enough to where you get a hot August, and it looks like 45 bushels, you end up at 35. So we'll have to see, and they've got room to raise it. Maybe they'll have room to raise the yield and the production and raise exports a little bit more too if China and U.S. get together and make nice and solve this problem.
Jerry, am I correct? USDA is still assuming a fairly robust average price for soybeans. I mean, it's over $9, right, that they've plugged in there?
Yeah, and I don't quite understand that, unless we're entering a new era where it doesn't matter how many beans we have, it's how much you're going to have to pay to get them out of our grubby hands, you know, because it's pretty foolish to be selling beans at levels that they're at now, because that's a loss, and then you're going to tell me that I'm supposed to plant some more of that same variety. So, you know, we've seen carryovers larger than normal that would imply lower prices. Maybe they're telling us something that we've got to take into consideration yet.
What do you say to that farmer? Obviously, there are these pockets. We've got an area of northwest Missouri, just terrible, the parts of Kansas. We get the feeling that those are few and far between, but USDA has been off with its crop ratings in the past. Is there any hope for that this time?
Well, we can always hope, I guess, but I look at it this way. There's a planted acres and there's a harvested acres. And in that harvested acres, you usually have pestilence, dryness, you have hail, and we harvest less than we produce. And it's not just that we grind it for silage. So I look at it and say, you know, if we don't have some of these spots, goodness, what kind of yield are we going to actually have in total, or the total production, which is really the bottom line to it. So I don't think we're in trouble yet, but there's a lot of talk out there by weathermen that we grew too fast too soon, and that we're going to run out of gas when it comes time to fill this stuff. So we'll see. You know, the latter half of July and then August was perfect last year. So if it isn't perfect this year, then maybe we can trim the yield. But even the top named up weather guys that are out there, and I'm sure your area as well, they're saying that looks like another good year finishing this crop.
Good news or bad news for livestock producers?
Well, it's good news. It should keep the corn relatively reasonable, but we have to be careful that we don't head back up. We think we'll head back up that 380 level. I don't know if we'll get to $4 again or not, but the fundamentals suggest that we will. Maybe we've got to go out to July of 2018 to lock that in, or 19 to lock that in. But the bad news for agriculture and the livestock sector is, you know, China has agreed to buy some meat from us, you know, and pork has been shunned, I guess, now. And they've also talked about buying beef. And we just don't need this curbing of demand here and elsewhere, and or Mexico, trying to find some substitutes while we're in the process of increasing the animal consuming units. You know that Informa uses to determine the demand for feed, and they did raise the feed usage, and the USDA did today, which we not surprised at that. But they're admitting to the fact that we got a lot of four-hoof critters to feed. So that could be a problem down the road.
I've got a little less than a minute to ask what, if anything, livestock producers should be doing in light of this report.
Well, I've heard a lot of people say to this, and their bankers would tell them that, is that if you have a profitable situation to lock in the price, you need to do that. We started locking in some feed needs about a week ago. We started buying corn 25% needs for the next marketing year. Pretty easy to do that, you know, at these kind of prices. We may do more, so if they lock in their inputs pretty well, that should help them. And of course, I don't know what's going to happen to pasture rent. Pasture looks pretty good, but pasture rent, farmland rent, that's a whole other subject. Maybe we'll be lowering these inputs finally that have been so stubbornly held stable for so long.
We'll go into that in our next visit. Jerry, thank you for taking a look at that report from USDA. Jerry Gulkey of the Gulkey Group. And right now, Max checks in with a look at weekly crop conditions from BASF. Max?
Checking on the crops out there this weekend. By this technical service representative, Vince Davis with BASF. Vince, I was just talking to some folks in Northwest Missouri. I was in that Kansas City area this week, and man, all they could talk about was the drought in some of those communities of Northwest Missouri and Eastern Kansas and how lousy the crop looked in the area that you cover, Northern Illinois, Southern Wisconsin. Do you see any drought conditions?
Max, we're in pretty good shape in most of our territory. Up in the central part of Wisconsin, we certainly have some areas that are getting on the droughty side. And in other areas, we have some places that could use a rain. They're showing some drought stress. The odd thing is a lot of that is occurring where in areas that already had water damage from too much water earlier in the spring and maybe didn't have real good root system under it, and now we've hit a dry spell where it's showing a little bit of drought stress, but it's kind of insult to injury in a few pockets.
That's one reason you like to see maybe a little bit of drier weather early in the season, right, to allow those roots to get down a little bit deeper.
I absolutely agree. We have a lot of good corn yields in years where we do have a little drier conditions real early in the spring that kind of force those roots deep in the soil, but I tell you, I don't want to focus too much on the negative, even though there are a few spots that don't look good. We still have, in a lot of southern Wisconsin, north half of Illinois, we have a lot of really good-looking crops out there, Max. A lot of good crops out there.
That is good to hear. The crop isn't in a bin yet, of course, as the producer at Asa to point out, and I've been seeing some of the social media shots of the aerial applicators at work, so the fungicide is still being applied, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We have really good crops out there, and I don't think I've ever seen a better year for investing in the crop we have in most of our fields. Fungicides are definitely going on hot and heavy in soybeans and corn in areas, which is a really good thing because there's certainly, with the weather patterns we've had, there's some real disease threats out there. On the corn side, northern corn leaf blight is starting to appear, and we've had real conducive conditions for it. I would not say northern corn leaf blight is coming in as early as it has the last couple of years, but it is certainly starting to appear. The bigger news is probably gray leaf spot in a lot of areas, seeing increased gray leaf spot from what we have in years past. So those are probably the two diseases in corn most top of mind.
What do you say to somebody with this kind of an economic situation, with these prices continuing to be depressed? What do you say to those folks who say, doggone it, I just don't know if I can invest any more in this crop, given the fact that the prices are still so low and aren't showing much sign of improvement?
Boy, I tell you, Max, that's one of the most difficult questions for us to deal with, and that's questions about pricing and marketing. And I just try to remind growers that we can't control those markets. We've never been able to control those markets. We just have to remember that a lot of those markets are volatile for a number of different reasons, many of which are political and relate to the world economy and comments on that scale. And we can't control that. What we can control is how many bushels we're going to pull out of those fields to the best of our ability. And that's the equation that, or part of the equation that I think we have to focus on. It's really a simple philosophy for me. Control the controllables and worry most about what you can influence yourself.
And we have several years of experience with using fungicides. I've had a couple of producers tell me, well, actually, retailers have told me that a producer says, hey, you know, we've got to do something with every acre out here. We need to try to enhance the yield. So we, in our particular operation, or this customer in his operation, is always wanting to utilize some fungicide on that acreage out there because they feel they've gotten results.
Absolutely. I mean, the fungicides we sell at BASF, we've created much of the plant health market and disease control market with Preaxor in soybeans as well as Headline Hemp in corn. And we've had those products on the market. They're some of the most proven products. Years of research shows a consistent return on investment over the course of averages, and we have a lot of producers that have a high enough level of management. They see that consistent return on investment, and it's just a necessity and a part of the annual budget to put on those crops and to return big yield. So that's a lot of what we see, and a lot of the research backs that up.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed that weather continues to treat our growers in this particular region well, and that we can get that yield in the bin, get it right in the front of that combine and get it in the bin this fall.
Absolutely, Max. I appreciate it.
Vince Davis, Technical Service Representative with BASF.
And before Max gets too far away, let's get a little more on the big show at Penfield, Illinois this weekend. Good morning again, Max.
Well, good morning, Orion, from Champaign County, Illinois, here in central Illinois. Yesterday, it was a hot day. It was warm, but we enjoyed being with folks at one of the best vintage farm equipment shows in the country, one of the finest and best attended antique tractor shows, the I&I Show, the one put on by the Illinois and Indiana Antique Tractor and Gas Engine Club. It's held in the Champaign County community of Penfield. That show continues today and again tomorrow, and it's kind of a mini half century of progress. Considerably smaller, a little more laid back. It's a little bit easier to get around. You can walk more readily from one place to another, but it's a great show. And thanks to the services provided by Air Orion yesterday, I made the trip from Penfield there in Champaign County through the Rantoul Airport to the Mercer County Airport at Aledo, Illinois, where they had the youth livestock auction at the Mercer County Fair last night. A well-attended event. And altogether, they brought in close to $50,000 for the champion livestock at that little county fair in Mercer County, Illinois, out a little bit south of the Quad Cities area. One thing that I noticed, that I know you've seen this time and again, Orion, is what an activity like this, an involvement in 4-H and FFA, will do for young people. How it helps them with their self-confidence, with their manners, with their speaking ability, and with their work ethic. One young person after another came up to me at that show yesterday, at that livestock show at Aledo, Illinois, stuck out their hand, shook my hand, and said, "Thank you, Mr. Armstrong, for being here." And I'm telling you, I thought maybe they were 22, 25, 26 years old. They were 15. They were 14. They were 16 years old. It's one more reminder of why we support 4-H and FFA and our county fairs that provide the venue, provide the outlet for these young people and the kind of leadership skills they are learning for the future. That's my report this morning. We look forward to seeing some folks later today at Penfield at the I&I Show, Orion.
All right, Max, thank you, and I'm glad that Air Orion made it around some of the thunderstorms and got you safely back to the Penfield show. It's been a busy morning, and we're out of time.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.